This is I'm Listening here on KXL 1039, 1450, and nhtalkradio.com. I'm Listening presented by Riverbend Community Mental Health, caring for the behavioral health of the community. For information, check out riverbendcmhc.org. Riverbend wants you to know that treatment works. We have a great show planned for you today, as always. And just a little bit, we joined by Bernie Sanders as Peter and I sat down with him down in Manchester a little bit earlier this week. And that conversation, as we continue to talk to presidential candidates about how they plan to address mental health. And we'll start off the program right now with Peter Evers, CEO of Riverbend Community Mental Health. Peter, how are you?
Good, thanks, Chris. How are you doing?
Good, appreciate you joining us for the show. We're going to start with a discussion about smartphones and depression. And now I would say anxiety as well, but the study that we're going to talk about is going to focus mostly on depression. And there has been a lot of discussion within the mental health community about this particular study. So take us through the findings.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting study. And I suppose I would preface it, Chris, by saying we don't know. And I think we've had this conversation before, a little bit like when the motor vehicle was introduced onto the streets of America and Europe. People said, well, people are going to die, they'll be run over all the time, and we just had no idea how it would affect people. Same here with smartphones. This is really with the first generation that has gone through getting a smartphone when you were at a very early age and then developing in a almost an addiction or dependence to it. And this is what this University of Arizona study is looking at. It's saying, is there a causal link between with older adolescents? And that's a very important group that they're looking at, because older adolescents right now are the generation that have brought up with smartphones. My kids are in their mid to late 20s now, and they didn't. You know, they were not raised with a smartphone in their hands, but this generation has been. And so they're looking at depression, and they're looking at whether or not dependence or heavy use of smartphones and dependence on them for anxiety, as you say, and depression is actually a cause. There's a causal link to depression. Or are people who have a tendency towards depression more likely to utilize their cell phones overly to deal with social situations, that kind of stuff? And I think they're beginning to feel that there is a causal link between overusage. And this study started by asking people at month zero and then month four, and then I think at month eight. And so there were interventions that went around on self use, you know, overlooking how much people are using. And they're beginning to find out that that people who do become dependent on using their phones develop depression in later adolescence to early adulthood. Not everybody, of course, but there is a link.
Why do they think that that takes place? Why do you become, you know, more depressed as a result of using a device?
So this is, I think, where this is the nub of the argument, really, because I think that there's the tendency towards social isolation begins before you ever
see. They're saying people become more socially isolated as a result of using their phone.
That's right. That's right.
I don't know. I think, you know, from my perspective, as an individual who deals with depression and anxiety, you know, a lot of times you're looking for distractions and things to, you know, take your mind off of, you know, what may be, whichever your mental state may be. And phones, video games, books, music, all these things provide that. And your phone has all of them right there in one. So it's a one-stop shop where you can do whatever you want there, and it provides for an escape from the current situation. I think that the problem that exists more so than what this study indicates is that for individuals who are growing up, like my kids and other kids in that, you know, at young adolescence to tween area, for them, their life is kind of in a constant state of altered reality, so that life itself is actually boring. Like I said, if you're constantly, you know, watching, you know, the sickest tricks on YouTube, and you're playing, you know, video games, and you're constantly being stimulated, life itself and mundane conversations with, you know, friends about how their day has been is boring. Right. And so looking for that constant new high, if you will, the new game, the new thrill, that's the danger, in my view, if you will, of cell phone usage. I think that an individual that is you know, depressed and isolated is going to use their phone to try to become less depressed and less isolated by connecting with something or some other individuals in a setting that they feel most comfortable with.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the whole debate, and I suppose the analog would be post-traumatic stress disorder. That, you know, that any given population, around 10% of the people who are involved in traumatic situations, and 9/11 is a good example of that, Chris. That a certain number of people in the population were, everybody was negatively affected by that. But a certain percentage, 8 to 10% of that population, were affected in a pathological way, that they found it difficult to function, that they were triggered, that they developed depression because of that. And I think that's true. We are faced with learning about a cell phone. And a cell phone can be so many different things. So a cell phone, somebody called it an opt-out option the other day, which I love that expression. You see people in meetings, especially meetings that I'm running, and you look around and five of those people are reading their cell phones. Well, whose fault is that? Well, maybe it's my fault because I don't keep them, you know, engaged. But those people are opting out, and that's an option to opt out. And then there's the piece about social isolation. In difficult social situations, how many times do you see people walking in to a large group of people and becoming overwhelmed by it and look at their cell phones immediately?
So
it plays all sorts of roles, but there is a certain percentage of the population who will utilize that to sort of double down on their social isolation, or that will then overly exaggerate their feelings of depression because they feel more isolated. They feel more removed from that normal connection. And, you know, you mentioned that before. There is no substitute for the human being for human contact. We are the most socialized animals on the planet. And I don't think any cell phone is going to, or smartphone is ever going to take away that that basic limbic response from humans.
But it is changing how we communicate, and you'll notice very often a lot of individuals are much more comfortable communicating via text or messenger versus actually having a conversation. And we notice it at times with our own family members that, as opposed to having a long conversation on the phone, we opt out of that in order to just provide basic, quick information via text, or individuals feel more empowered to say things via text, or, you know, leaving a comment online, whatever, that they would never say in person. So interpersonal communications is changing, I think. No, there's still going to be that communication that takes place, but, you know, looking at your meeting as an example, students are not going to be able to learn moving forward, or people who are having meetings. That's going to be very difficult because it's going to be incredibly boring just to watch an individual speak. We need a multi-platform presentation now in order for individuals to be able to communicate with one another effectively. So just having a speaker or a lecturer in college, it doesn't work anymore. And it's because, as I've referenced before, you know, individuals are growing up and they are incredibly accustomed to seeing the best in speakers, seeing the best in production and production value. So they're not going to be able to connect on that personal level the same way that individuals may have in the past.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's true, but I also think we adjust. So I was thinking the other day about, actually I was watching some YouTube, which is, again, this is how you get your information. But I was interested in the change in the political climate when they first televised these debates, having watched one of them, endured one of them, I should say, the other day. And it was that, and the piece was about Nixon and Kennedy, which of course is the famous one where Nixon becomes somewhat sweaty, I think,
yeah,
and looks like he's not trustworthy. And I asked myself the question. I didn't answer it, by the way. I'm good at asking myself questions and not always answer them. But I asked the question, how much has that changed the political landscape in the last 50 years? Because I think it was around about the late 60s that that happened. I'm not sure. But we still have a system that is pretty similar to pre-TV adverts or TV debates.
The system is the same, right. But individuals who were elected president in the past, and I've talked about this a lot, and some of our greatest presidents, Abraham Lincoln, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, there's no way that they would be able to be elected in this current environment where it's entertainment focused, HDTV. I've talked a lot about John McCain versus Barack Obama in the HDTV era, where there was a clear difference in age, obviously, and that was played out. And yeah, I mean, that's the famous debate between Nixon and JFK is talked about in that in 1960. Is talked about in that people who watched it on TV thought that JFK won. People who listened to it on the radio thought that Nixon won. And then, you know, there's the written aspect of things where if you, in the course of a radio or TV experience, words get lost and are, you know, you may not catch everything, and some things you'll keep, some things you won't. In the written print aspect of things, it's all there, and you can go back and review it. And so those three different mediums are remarkably different in how they affect individuals being able to cognitively accept and retain them.
Yeah, and I suppose I might say that if Lincoln had had his best men and women around him to assess what the situation is and then manipulate or use those media or medium, should I say, in a way that would get the message over best, wouldn't he have done that?
But he was a gangly, depressed, shrieky-voiced individual who would not play well in this current environment, and where the presentation is more important than the substance or the message. So, yeah, I honestly don't think that Lincoln could be elected today.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose my thought about this is that these basic human requirements for us to exist will overcome whatever is put in front of us. And in some ways, and you're right, I see the smartphone as a brilliant thing. I wanted to know about a movie, an English movie the other night, I couldn't remember who the actress was. And within 15 seconds, I realized it was Sylvia Sims and the argument was over, which actually does cut some of those arguments quite short. But that's good. But there's many things I think that we have to worry about. But I do think that we will come to exist peacefully with the smartphone once we've worked out what the dangers are. And all of this article was saying that human beings really must regulate themselves on the usage of this so that they can get back to what you talked about right at the beginning of this, which is normal face-to-face verbal communication, which is the essence of human life.
That is Peter Evers. I am Chris Ryan. Coming up next, our conversation with Bernie Sanders. What are you looking forward to talking to Bernie about?
Well, of course, healthcare. And I know that's his big thing. It's in terms of mental health, it's where does mental health fit within healthcare? And what's he going to do to create a situation where we can work towards parity for mental health? Those are the things I'm looking forward to asking about.
That is Peter Evers. I am Chris Ryan. Bernie Sanders, one of the leading Democratic candidates for president, is up next here on I'm Listening, which is presented by Riverbend Community Mental Health. Treatment works. More information, check out riverbendcmhc.org.
This is I'm Listening here on KXL 189, 1450 and nhtalkradio.com, presented by Riverbend Community Mental Health. And as we continue to discuss the issue of mental health with presidential candidates, we're going to be joined on the program today by U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders from Vermont, one of the top Democratic candidates for president, winner of the 2016 New Hampshire primary, is always joined by Peter Evers, the CEO of Riverbend Community Mental Health. And Senator Sanders, how are you?
I'm great.
Appreciate joining us for the program. We see, as through the eyes of individuals that are uniquely fixed on this problem, mental health being, if not the biggest, one of the biggest public health epidemics in our country right now, and rising and manifesting itself in so many different ways. I'm curious as to how you see mental health affecting individuals in this nation and what type of priority it would take in your administration.
Chris, you're absolutely right. I go around the country and I talk about healthcare a whole lot, and there's hardly a meeting that I'm at where people do not raise the issue of mental health, the inability to find the counseling and the help that they need at a price that they can afford to pay. I've gotten calls in my office in Burlington, and I'm sure other senators have, from people who say, and this is, I remember this distinctly, my staff told me, I am worried that my brother will do something terrible to himself or to somebody else. We've been searching for the help that we need, and we can't find it, and we can't find it now. And if you're in a mental health crisis, 6 months from now, getting an appointment is not going to do you any good. So there's no question that we have a crisis. And by the way, that crisis exists in the classrooms of a country. These are for young children. These are for teenagers. You know, we talk about the opioid addiction. I did a town meeting in Burlington High School a year ago. Oh, my God, you talk about kids and asking them why they're turning to drugs, and you look at the kind of stress and depression that many of the young people are. You talk about old people who, surprisingly large numbers, become alcoholic, right, dependent on alcohol and drugs. We got a major crisis in this country, and it's a crisis that has to be dealt with. And let me just simply say to start with that one of the reasons that I support and my legislation is the lead legislation on Medicare for All is that it provides health care to all people as a human right, and obviously that includes mental health care as well.
Yeah, Senator, thank you so much for taking this so seriously. I think, you know, as we approach what I see as a crisis in healthcare, and access to healthcare, we also have to make sure that the behavioral health issues, the issues of substance use and mental health, are paid attention to. And I think we've been shouting for many years that there doesn't seem to be a great deal of parity in healthcare for issues like mental illness and substance abuse. And there is also a lot of stigma that exists about that. I believe that getting health care to people who don't have it now is the first step of really addressing mental health care for people.
I think you're absolutely right. And as I've mentioned to Chris on numerous occasions as we have our discussions, we spend twice as much per person on health care as do the people of any other country. And yet we have 87 million people who are uninsured or underinsured, and we pay by far the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs, such that one out of five Americans can't even afford the medicine that their doctors prescribe. That's insane. That is dysfunctionality at the highest level. So, you know, what I believe is that under a Medicare for All system, there is no premiums, no deductibles, no co-payments, no out-of-pocket expenses. When you are sick, including mental health issues, you walk into a doctor when you should. Now, by the way, that will solve a lot of the problems, but it doesn't solve the problems that we need more psychologists, more counselors, more psychiatrists for children and for everybody else. And we've got to start focusing a healthcare system on the needs of the American people and not just making sure that the healthcare industry can make $100 billion in profit, which is what they did last year.
So how does that happen in your view? Because you're 100% right. And the other issue is creating an environment of parity where an individual walks into their primary care physician and is not asked dismissive type questions of, you're not drinking too much, are you? Or you're not suicidal, are you? Where there needs to be, in my view, in the optimal situation, would be a individual that is experienced and has the wherewithal in mental and physical health as a primary care physician.
Well, you know what, Chris? I mean, your point and Peter's point touches even on a broader issue. And we're looking at the depersonalization of healthcare in America today. You can have great hospitals where people are seen by 15 different specialists. You're divided up between your heart and your lungs and your knees and your ankles rather than looking at you as a human being. And, you know, maybe I'm old-fashioned about this, but there was once a time when people in this country had a doctor of their own. And I know people won't believe me when I say this. Doctors even made home visits. Oh, my God, you were sick, and they went to your home. But you've got to start off with a strong, and Peter, you correct me if I'm wrong, but a strong primary care system. So in the midst of a dysfunctional and expensive healthcare system today, probably the worst crisis in the midst of this is our primary care system is broken, so that you got millions of people, even those with insurance, don't have a, what we call a medical home of their own. So if you have a medical home and you have a doctor who knows you and you're walking in there and say, you know, I'm having trouble sleeping or I'm really worried that I'm drinking too much, the doctor can say, okay, listen, I'm going to make an appointment for you to go see somebody else who really is a specialist in that area. But to start with, I think we need to go back to the idea that the people of this country are entitled to a doctor who knows their family, right? If you have emotional issues, you know, you're in a divorce or you're worried about your kid, you know what, that's going to impact your state of being. So that is why I'm a strong advocate of Medicare for All, which, again, no out-of-pocket expenses, no premiums, no co-payments, no deductibles. You go to the doctor that you want, you get the care that you want. Now, having said that, creating a system in which we have doctors where we need them, all right? There are some parts of this country where you got too many dermatologists, and you got this one, and you got that one, and yet there are parts of America, not only where we don't have enough mental health physicians and counselors, you don't even have enough medical doctors. There are counties in America that have no medical doctors.
One thing before we get back to Peter. So do you feel that a Medicare for All solution would break up the large-scale conglomerate primary care entities and we'd see a return of local doctors who would rise up as a result of that, or would there be specific policy to...
All that I'm saying, I mean, what Medicare for All is simply about, it says the function of healthcare should not be to make billions in profits for the drug companies, and the insurance companies should provide healthcare to all as a human right. Now, having said that, that doesn't solve all the problems. I mean, if that happened tomorrow, it would be a huge step forward. People would start getting the care. But that does not mean that we have, and Peter, correct me if I'm wrong, do we have, and I can tell you in Vermont, we don't have enough child psychiatrists. I suspect that's true.
Absolutely.
That's true,
right?
In New Hampshire and
absolutely
around the country. All right. We don't have enough counselors. In terms of the opioid addiction crisis that has hit this state so hard, it's hit Vermont, other states as well, do we have the kinds of counseling and help that we need? No, we don't. So what we have got to do, but the advantage of Medicare for All is when you have a system that is not designed simply to profit the insurance companies and the drug companies, you can begin to deal with the real problems. So question is, all right, what kind of doctors do we need? Do we need more dermatologists on Park Avenue in New York? Probably not. Do we need more child psychiatrists in Manchester, New Hampshire, and Burlington, Vermont? I suspect we do. So through a variety of ways, you provide the incentives to medical school people and say, look, we need you to be practicing in underserved areas. We need you to become psychologists, counselors, nurses, psychiatrists, whatever it may be. But when you're not functioning under the need to make huge profits for the insurance companies, I think there's a lot that we can do.
I think one of the things that is really important is to shift the emphasis. What do we really want from our healthcare system? Do we want to make more encounters so we make more money? Or do we want to invest in a healthcare system that is preventative, that we're shifting acute care towards preventative work? And that, I don't think, can happen when you have drug companies making a lot of money, when you have big conglomerates. And you also have to shift the incentive to the doctor. Chris and I talk about this a lot. A vascular surgeon can make four times what a psychiatrist does. The average age of a psychiatrist in this country is 59, and we're only producing 1,100 of them in America this year.
And then, you know, talk about the number of primary care physicians. I mean, there are primary care physicians in New England, I suspect, making $90,000 to $100,000 a year, a fraction of what specialists make, doing some of the most important and difficult work. They're on call 7 days a week. Who determined that set of priorities? And that's wrong. And that is what you have when you have a system designed for profit rather than addressing real needs.
What would you like to see in terms of implementation of mental health care services from an education perspective in schools? And also, how would you like to see mental health care professionals utilized instead of police? And Peter is part of mobile psychiatric unit that Riverbend has pushed forth, which has been very successful in New Hampshire, and that has been expanded upon in the current budget.
Well, to begin with, let me take the discussion in a little bit different direction. And that is to tell you that everything is related to everything else. You can't segregate something and say, oh, we just got a mental health crisis.
That's a great point, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right? Somebody once said to me, they said, here's a study that said that X percent, a very high percentage, of people sleeping out on the street are dealing with mental illness. And my response was, guess what? If you slept out on the street, you would have mental illness. Think about, you don't know where you're going to sleep today. It's cold. You don't have enough food. You're not going to have mental illness. You will have mental illness. So we have to remember, you talk about the schools, a significant number of kids today, because of the nature of our economy and the income and wealth inequality that we see. These kids, I talk to teachers, I'm sure you do. They're coming into school. They're not fed adequately. They don't have good nutrition. They're living in families where maybe their mom or their dad is dealing with addiction. They don't get enough sleep. And you have to look at that as well. All right? Life expectancy in the United States of America is actually in decline because we have a level, what the doctors call diseases of despair. People are giving up. So if you are somebody who is making $9 an hour and you can't take care of your kids, you know what? I can understand. Don't support it. You turn to a palliative like drugs or alcohol. And then what happens to the children? So all that I'm saying, Chris, is that everything has got to be looked at in the totality of what goes on in our society today. Half of our people are living paycheck to paycheck. Millions of people are spending 50% of their limited incomes on housing. People can't find decent housing. And if you think all of that stuff, the stress, what I have been amazed about, and we don't talk about this enough, is just the economic stress that people facing every single day. If you don't get your paycheck, if your car breaks down, what happens to you? You may lose your job. Mm-hmm. If you lose your job, you can't feed your families. So all that I'm saying here is that at the end of the day, to address mental illness in the future is preventative. And to be preventative, we have to create a society where so many of our people are not living under the incredible stress they are right now. Peter, does that make sense to you?
It makes perfect sense.
And we talk about that all the time. Yeah. Because in my view, the economic stressors of our current situation in this country is not necessarily driving mental illness, but is driving mental health. And those economic conditions and solving the economic conditions in rural and urban areas, in my view, could create much less usage of drugs and alcohol.
Absolutely.
And mental health. Do you agree with that, Peter?
And what would it look like if you could write a prescription for fresh fruits or for a refrigerator to keep your medications in? We do not pay any attention to the social determinants of health, which is exactly what you're speaking about. And if we don't do that, the 10 minutes spent in a doctor's office does not do anything to right what's going on for those people who are suffering with these inequities in our society.
You know, it's a funny thing. I saw this. You know, I am a fan, it's no great secret, of a lot of what Scandinavia does. Mm-hmm. And they do these international polls about which people are the quote-unquote happiest of the world. All right, we can take it all with a grain of salt. But often it's countries like Norway and Denmark that come out on top. And you know why, I think, is if you do not have to worry about health care, if you don't have to worry about sending your kid to college, if you don't have to worry about housing, doesn't mean to say you're not going to have worries. Everybody, you know, people get divorced, people have problem kids. Everybody in the world does. But it takes a tremendous load off of your shoulders that you don't have to struggle every single day for the basic necessities of life. So I think we don't pay enough attention to that reality, and it is connected certainly to the incredible stress that so many of our people are living under, the anger that people are feeling, and that obviously impacts one's mental health.
Yeah, and somebody who is a product of a national health service in another country was pretty shocked.
Do you want to take a guess as to which country that is, Bernie?
I was pretty shocked when I came to work and found that my employer would actually provide my health care, and I still think that that's something that we need to look at. But just on workforce for a minute, because in healthcare, actually in New Hampshire, we have a negative employment rate. I think we have 2,500 vacancies in healthcare, within mental health, about 250. It's all about pay. Our rates are related to Medicaid rates that haven't changed for a decade or so. And we strive to be a $15 an hour employer, which we are. But that's not enough. It's not enough to raise a family on. And how are we going to retain those people in a workforce that
Peter,
is in need?
It is, again, and what our campaign is trying to do, if I can become political, is kind of change the priorities and the value system of this country. We have mental health counselors, and I see them in Vermont, who are occasionally on food stamps. Is that the case? Well, I mean, that's a little bit crazy, if I may say so. It's absurd that people who are doing enormously important work, literally trying to save people's lives, are themselves living under financial distress. I'm sure you will agree with me in that we need a strong child care system, make sure that kids get off to a good start in life. And Chris, correct me if I'm wrong, but I bet there are child care workers in the state, certainly in Vermont, who are making, what, $12-$13 an hour?
No, it's true, but there's flip side to that, too, where child care can be extremely expensive as well, particularly for middle-class families. But the workers themselves, they are not doing very well off of it.
Right, and it's expensive because you have a low ratio of staff to children. But again, this is changing the priorities of America. If you're talking about mental health, you got to focus on making sure that our children are healthy and happy and get the intellectual and emotional nourishment that they need. And if you don't do that, and if these kids get into school and they're already 2 years behind and they're in trouble, it's only going to get worse. So, you know, what we have got to do, and I know, you know, I'm considered to be radical, I guess, by some, is to change the national priorities of this country. Invest in our children. Invest in mental health. Do everything we can to prevent the conditions that lead to stress and mental illness. Make sure that people are able to afford the medicine that they need. This to me seems to be kind of a no-brainer. But to do that, we're going to have to take on a lot of very powerful people.
Yeah, and I think that has to happen. I think the other thing is, how do you persuade a population that's something that they need? Because there doesn't seem to be that kind of universal agreement that everybody should have health care.
I don't agree with you. I think the people are there. I think, and it's not a question of persuading, I think you have a pharmaceutical industry. Don't get me going. You'll be on the radio now for 2 hours. I think that they are not only greedy, they are incredibly corrupt and engaged in price fixing, which is why we pay so much. I was, I told Chris this, just as one example of 100. A couple of months ago, I went to Canada with people suffering from diabetes. Okay, we bought insulin, same exact product sold in the United States for one-tenth of the price. It's not a question of talking to these guys. They spend billions of dollars on lobbying and campaign contributions so they can charge anybody any price that they want. It is disgraceful. And trust me, this is an issue I feel passionately about. We will take them on. But it's not, I think the American people are there. I think the American people know that mental health is a huge issue that we don't talk enough about. They want more resources going, not only to deal with addiction, but mental health problems in general for children, for adults. But we are taking on an industry that is much more concerned about their profits than the needs of the American people.
The final thing for me is on the issue of stigma and mental health. And we have taken, in my view, remarkable steps. The fact that we're having conversations with presidential candidates about this issue, where in the past it was not really even discussed, to me is incredibly significant. Individuals have stepped forward and said that they suffer from mental illness. And bringing it out to the forefront where it truly is parity, receives parity in the public discussion, is incredibly important. And there's a discussion about suicide. You mentioned the fact that life expectancy was going down, suicide and disease of despair, the big reason for that. Individuals are actually living longer on average when you take out the suicide aspect, but the suicides are so significant that they're bringing that number down.
But it's also, you're absolutely right, but it's also a class issue.
That's also true.
That there's unbelievable gap. I don't have it in my mind, but I think it's like 15 years between people living in the wealthiest community and people living in the poorest communities. 15 years of life expectancy. It's unbelievable.
And stress and healthy eating is a huge part of that.
Absolutely. So, you know, there is, and let me congratulate you, Peter, for the work you're doing. I mean, thank you.
There's a lot of us doing some good
work. I know there are. All over the country, there are great people doing enormously important work. And my job as President of the United States is to get you the resources that you need to deal with the problems that you see, but even more importantly, to do our best to prevent these problems starting from our youngest children.
Really appreciate your time, appreciate your focus on this issue, and look forward to talking again soon.
Well, Chris, let me congratulate you and Peter. I mean, as you just indicated, there's still a lot of stigma around mental illness, and the way that we defeat that stigma is to bring it out in the open and to talk about it. So thank you both for what you're doing.
Yeah, I feel
thank
like you. we're 20% of the way yes. on this issue, right. But that 20% was really hard earned. Yes. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Bernie Sanders joining us here on I'm Listening on KXL, presented by Riverbend Community Mental Health. I'm Listening here on KXL 109, 1450, and nhtalkradio.com. I'm Listening is presented by Riverbend Community Mental Health. We're inside the Concord Photo Service Main Street studio. Riverbend wants you to know the treatment works. For more information, check out riverbendcmhc.org. Takeaways from our conversation with Bernie Sanders.
Interesting. Thought it was great that I managed to get a shot in about the National Health Service in Britain. And, you know, I think it's one of those things, isn't it, Chris, where right from 25,000 feet or whatever, this seems obvious. This seems, well, of course, you have to take the money away from Big Pharma and large industrial complex medical providers and insurance companies. But that's the essence of the argument is, how do you do that? How do you take away things that people already have and say, this is going to be good for you?
Right. And what is the process in regards to how that takes place? So that there's the how, then there's the implementation, then there's the time period, then there's, you know, the pain that goes along with that, because there's going to be, you know, big, significant changes. You know, are more people going to want to work in the healthcare industry? Are less people going to want to work in the healthcare industry? So, you know, Bernie, and I've talked a lot with Bernie over the years. Bernie is great at identifying the key issues that are afflicting our country on healthcare, on Wall Street, on a lot of different aspects of things. The challenge, though, is what is the best way in order to go about dealing with them. If you were starting your own country, Medicare for All makes a lot of sense, but that's not going to take place. And we have seen, you know, it is very, very difficult to implement even the slightest change in healthcare or in any industry. And to say that you're going to, you know, throw out the entire healthcare system, and, you know, people, he says, well, people want Medicare for All. Healthcare is a human right. So, in my view, the best thing is to get to a place that is the best situation that is presented within our current structure. So, for you, what would Medicare for All, you know, look like? And you've seen the proposal, read the bill, and seen what is that going to mean for a healthcare provider?
So that's a brilliant question. And so I suppose we should assume, for the sake of this few next sentences, that we've managed to transform, that we have. And, you know, interestingly enough, the National Health Service in Britain was built after the Second World War. In some ways, when the country was razed, when the country was just destroyed by war.
And they were
this country was starting over again.
It sort of was. Yeah. You know, education started, unionization started. It was a time when really the workers' rights were at their highest because they'd just won the war for Britain. And we're not going to be faced with a time like that. It's interesting. What does it mean? It means, on the positive side, I think, for me, it means that things like the head of Centene, which is a managed care organization that works for Medicaid. So think about that. Most of their contracts are for Medicaid. The head of that agency earns $26 million a year. And that is repeated with all of these companies, you know, up and down the country. It means that those resources get reallocated or reabsorbed into the health system, which is a good thing.
It also, which would mean raises and higher rates of pay for doctors, nurse practitioners. No,
I don't think so.
So where would the $26 million go?
Well, that would get the $26 million would be equitably spread across the system, so that healthcare.
So costs would go down?
Well, costs would go down eventually. Yes, yeah. They would, because salaries aren't so high, and that's the rub. So. Again, look at socialized medicine, if you want to call it, in other countries. Doctors are not paid what they are here in Norway and Sweden and France.
But here, there's a distinct difference between what specialists make and what primary care physicians make.
Absolutely.
So in Denmark or the other Scandinavian countries that Bernie likes to point out, as you mentioned, do primary care physicians make more than they do here?
Yes, they do, because they have a population health base. And we talked a little bit about this with Bernie, that as long as you're spending more of your money on the acute side of healthcare as opposed to the community or preventative side, then costs will always be ramped up and your specialists will be rewarded the most. So the vascular surgeons and the surgeons in general are rewarded at a higher level. In those countries, because primary care is the first layer of defense for population health or value-based care prevention, those people are more equitably paid. So it's more leveling of the playing field. But you don't get, heart surgeons or heart consultants that are earning $1 million a year. That's just not possible. So that's a consequence that you'd have to take into account. But I do think, and maybe this is a too broad a statement, but most of all in medicine, people don't go into medicine to make a lot of money. Some of them do, but I think most people are driven to be part of a system that actually promotes wellness of a society. But we've been in a situation where big businesses run healthcare for a long time, and we have to reverse that. So there's good and bad. More people get covered. People will not be able to leverage their income to get to the top of the list.
Mm-hmm.
Again, if you have a lot of money, that's a bad thing. If you don't, it's a good thing because healthcare is more equitably spread. And with medicine that is government paid comes the ability to pay for preventative health, which has no real yield at the moment for businesses that run healthcare.
So the thing about healthcare, which is different than other sectors, is you may look at a professional athlete and say, there's no way on earth that Mookie Betts should make $35 million. But the system as it's built up, a free market system which fans pay, rate payers pay, TV revenues, advertisers, they're getting their fair share of that, of the structure that has been built and negotiated. Healthcare is completely different in that no one really knows what they're paying and what the doctors are making and what difference there is between one doctor and another. But some individuals are becoming insanely rich off of this system. And, I'm not going to be an arbiter of whether a really good or average vascular surgeon should be insanely rich or not. To me, medicine is, as you referenced before, I think that it's interesting because I don't know how individuals feel about what they're pursuing. To me, like, medicine and healthcare providers are, it's kind of an aspect of volunteerism, so to speak, where you're you know, you're wanting to be handsomely, you want to be paid for your work and for what you do. But I mean, are you supposed to become a millionaire off of, you know, providing healthcare that helps other individuals? Or are you supposed to become insanely rich off of, you know, even a very basic practice? I don't know. But it's not an equitable system, because you're becoming rich off of basically the insurance payments, the insurance side of things, and the costs are escalated because they're really shielded from individuals. So the system has a tremendous amount of money in it, but there's not a lot of transparency as to why that money is there.
Yeah, and I mean, how ridiculous is it that if you're a large conglomerate insurance agency that can throw its weight around, or a Partners Healthcare, which is a health system that can throw its weight around, you can negotiate lower rates for your members as opposed to somebody who has free care who has to pay three or four times
right.
that. And that's just not equitable, and it's not fair. And it's a hidden cost to people, because healthcare is, you're absolutely right, there's no other industry on the planet that has the ability to hide what it costs or what it pays for. And, you know, there's a book called American Sickness. I've talked about it, by Elizabeth Rosenwald, I think her name is. And, you know, she says if you want a hip replacement, you know, in one place in Boston, it'll cost you $32,000. If you go to the town over, it'll cost you $5,000.
Right.
Why does an MRI cost so much in this country when in Japan it's $200? All of those things, I think, have to be looked at. You know, but one of the things that worries me, Chris, is that people with resources will buy services regardless. And what happened in Britain actually was that you had these dual systems. You had people who would go outside of the national health care business and charge people cash who could afford it. And then you get to draw away the resources from the National Health Service because people can get paid much more doing work with wealthy people. And that's a risk, I think, to the system. And that's something Bernie would have to think about, I think.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a lot of individuals that would go out on their own and would continue their practices in that type of a setting. What would the penalty be for that? That's a good question right. for the candidates moving forward. Peter, as always, appreciate joining us for the program.
Yes,
Peter Evers, this is I'm Listening here on KXL, presented by Riverbend Community Mental Health. Riverbend wants you to know the treatment works. For more information, check out riverbendcmhc.org.